Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. He's one DJ that has been there, done that, and done it all again. And for almost three decades, Judge Jules has led the way in the world of dance music. Since hitting the decks in 1987, Judge Jules has influenced an entire generation on Kiss FM and Radio 1 and continues to be on the playlists of millions with his weekly radio show, The Global Warm-Up, which notches up to 750,000 downloads every single week via his podcast. As a pioneer of the club scene, passion and persona behind the decks, coupled with crowd connection and unrivaled mixing, has earned Judge Jules unforgettable sets at the world's most iconic clubs and festivals, including Gatecrasher, Ministry of Sound, Global Gathering, and Creamfields. In the studio, Judge Jules has released over 100 tracks, and he's mixed compilations for Ministry of Sound, Universal, and Warner Brothers, which have racked up over 3 million sales. Earning his place amongst DJ legends, Judge Jules has received accolades such as number one DJ by Mix Mag, best international DJ by Dawnstar Awards, best radio DJ by Smirnoff's Dawnstars, and has consistently featured in the DJ Mag Top 100 poll, peaking at number 3 alongside the industry's greatest. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Judge Jules. Where do we find you in the world? How are you doing and what's happening in your life?
Well, I'm one of these very strange individuals who has spent a lifetime of being a DJ and music maker. But about 10 years ago, I set up my own specialist music law practice as well, where I look after mainly people in the dance and electronic music world. So at the moment, I'm sat in my office. It's a more sedate and more a serene environment than if you caught me behind the deck somewhere.
Why did you choose the alias Judge Jules?
Now, does anybody choose their own alias? That's the question. Yes, I think is the plural of alias, alii. Let's pretend it is because it sounds funny. The best alii are chosen for you by your friends.
Okay.
And we go back to the age of about 16 to 18. I got into DJing by promoting illegal parties. At the time, I was a law student, and my friends, what are you when you're young? You're brave and you're quite stupid. And I was both, dare I say it. And when the police turned up to our numerous illegal events, I was always thrust in front of them, telling the officers who turned up to our very large illegal raves that it was a party officer for my law student chums, which of course was a complete concoction.
Yeah.
And for that reason, my friends gave me the moniker The Judge, and it's stuck ever since.
That's cute. I like that. So now you've tapped into or touched on it a little bit. So let's rewind to your beginning in the entertainment industry. So at what age did you decide, cool, I love music, I love the entertainment world, I want to progress into that world? And how did that journey accumulate to where we are today?
It's almost a given when you are if you aspire to be in the music industry, that you've got to be an absolute geek, you know, really a geek and a fanatic. And, you know, when you're young, you don't want to call yourself a geek. And as you get older and become more comfortable in your own skin, it's acceptable to acknowledge the fact that you probably are a bit of a geek and were since day one. So, you know, I had the biggest record collection. It was back in the vinyl era. In my immediate social circle, we used to just spend all our waking hours and all our hard-earned sort of pennies, even from the age of sort of 11 or 12, going and buying records, both new and old. And that becomes, if you like, the epicenter of your social life when you're 13, 14, 15. But of course, as you get a bit older and I don't know, relationships and all the rest of it come into your life, you think, well, you know, this is becoming a little bit embarrassing, this obsession. I need to do something to kind of justify my addiction. So DJing and wanting to share the music that you love with people, because music's a social thing, isn't it? So we started putting on parties age 16, actually. I found a couple of venues that were prepared to turn a blind eye here in London to predominantly underage clientele who were sort of getting drunk. And, well, I wouldn't say they're falling all over the place because it was more about the music. But, you know, and what you don't realise at the time is that is the point in your life probably where you will have the largest social circle, because nobody at that age has really got anything to do. But there are lots of them, and you and friends of friends hang out, and it really all sort of blossomed from there. We started putting on events. I then went to university when I was 18, got into pirate radio and started putting on raves for, you know, for overage people, albeit only marginally overage. And that's expanded over a long period. The events got very successful. We did lots of them. They were in and around various areas of London during an era in the late 80s where it was a lot more derelict kind of industrial properties where one could hold these things in relatively central London. Now, if you wanted to find those sort of derelict properties, you'd have to go miles out of the city to do so. And it blossomed from there, and it generated various other, if you like, lanes to my career of doing more radio, doing more pirate radio, and then getting into legitimate radio, doing more music making, and generally just cutting my teeth as a DJ and feeling more comfortable in front of a crowd, because I don't think anybody is going to be immediately comfortable in front of a crowd. You need to get used to it. You need to understand the dynamic. You need to feed off the crowd. And I think I picked that element up quite early. I mean, I'm in my fourth decade of DJing. These days I do probably 80 to 100 gigs a year, which I still find quite astonishing. Not that one is ever complacent and one needs to work hard and one is only as good as one's last gig. But I think that degree of kind of feeling comfortable and feeding off the crowd, feeding off the energy of the crowd, is very difficult to explain unless you've actually lived it and experienced it, because it's a unique drug. It's a unique, you know, it's unique petrol in your engine.
You've mentioned that you picked up the energy of the crowd at an earlier on in the career. What was the thing that helped you realize, okay, cool, I'm picking up this energy, and what is it that you have to be aware of the crowd in order to understand it?
Well, I suppose, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, first and foremost, you've got to have fairly good ears for the right records, because if you haven't, it's a non-starter.
Yeah.
And, you know, assuming that sort of basic bedrock of being a successful DJ, you've got to realise that you've got to understand the ebb and flow of the crowd. You've got to understand that some crowds are more hungrier for brand new, unheard music. Some crowds are a bit more commercial, and there's every shade in between those two sort of polar opposites. And, you know, I'm lucky enough not to have to do too many shows where they're exceptionally commercial. And I've probably never been a DJ that's been at the absolute ice cold underground end either. I've always sat somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
But it's understanding that dynamic and having the right weapons in your musical arsenal to kind of deal with those situations, because there's always an ebb and flow on every dance floor, even in the world's greatest clubs and festivals. There's always a bit of an up and down, whether you can see it numerically in terms of numbers of people on the dance floor or whether you feel it more just from the general energy vibe. There's always peaks and troughs, and it's understanding those and being able to kind of manipulate those so that people walk away at the end of your set saying wow, and, you know, metaphorically open mouthed.
To create a set for a events or an evening or whatever, what goes into that creation, and does the energy of what's happening in the room sometimes change what you performing and what you playing?
Always. It always does.
Okay.
I never really the work as a DJ that one does is done before you even take the decks. It's knowing the records within your record box, having thought about either strategically or organically knowing what's going to work together. And then it's like a Rubik's Cube that never requires the same solution. You occasionally at some really big events where you've got a very limited time, you know, what those kind of big festivals where you might have a shorter set than normal, like an hour, where you've got to make an immediate impact. Might have the first two or three records prepared. But beyond that, you've simply got to, I think the skill in of any DJ is knowing what to play and putting it together in the right order, spontaneously.
it's a bit of an opposite there. Knowing what to play, but being spontaneous at the same time. I like that. You mentioned earlier on about pirate radio and normal or traditional radio. So for the listeners who do not know, what is the difference between the two? And is there either one that you prefer personally?
Well, pirate radio is illegal radio that's not licensed. In the UK, operating in certain major cities, particularly in London, on the FM band, generally speaking, filling a market that's not catered for is it, I've got a lot of time for. And in my youth, there was certainly a very strong gap in the market, playing records that represented UK and particularly London club culture, club and rave culture, that just weren't getting a look in anywhere else.
So the pirate radio was, just to confirm, was a place to play those, that type of music that wasn't being featured on other anywhere on the radio at all. Is that correct?
Yeah, filling a gap in the market. But it's also, there's an element of anarchy about pirate radio where some of the rules didn't apply, you know, arguably talking in the wrong places on the record and not everybody talking with the same voice. I think, you know, having regional or having like London accents now doesn't matter at all. But there was a long period where you almost had to sound like the stereotypical BBC presenter to even get a look in on legal radio.
So obviously then pirate radio perceivably could be freer in the sense that there's no sort of structure. You're creating your own flow.
Yes, there were most of the more successful pirate stations then and now have a certain amount of advertising, albeit there's only so many brands that, generally smaller brands, that would be prepared to advertise with pirate radio. So there's a bit of kind of structure to it. It's not totally turn up and, you know, finish when you want. You know, there's a show schedule and but you're not sort of measured by the traditional I don't know, Rajar, which is the way that we measure radio listening figures here in the UK, for example. There's no focus groups whereby the broadcast kind of corporation will sit certain radio shows in front of the focus group and decide whether they like them or not. There's none of that stuff.
Are there still pirate radio stations today, or is that not a thing anymore?
There are some in London still, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Now, let's go into your other career, your law. What elements of law do you practice and how do you assist in the dance DJ world?
Well, it's music and entertainment. I negotiate deals and contracts from beginning to end. And there's a massive spectrum, really. Anything music related, if there's a music deal to be done, and there's a huge spectrum of different music deals that can be done, I can do it for people. I'm sort of specialized in contracts and in, dare I say, being a bit of a hustler on the people I represent's behalf.
From that, what is your feeling? And I know this is a controversial topic. So what is your feeling around AI and specifically in the music industry?
AI has been the buzzword, obviously, in life as in music for about the past 12 months. And there's a lot of stuff that AI can do. It can replicate vocalists, singers' voices. You can record vocalists, you can singing and spoken word. In theory, you can write songs. But I think there is an inbuilt limitation to AI, which is that most of the style leading creatives, let's talk DJ producers, to talk particularly about my world,
yes,
are always quite ahead of the game. So if you were to go and hear some of the world's leading DJs, they'd be playing the music that they're making that will be released in 3 to 6 months' time. That's what you'll hear in their DJ sets. AI can only replicate what's out there in the marketplace now. So AI can't predict the way that a creative's mind is going to work going forward. They can only replicate what a creative's mind is going to do now. And of course, at a mainstream level, that might be enough. But most people who love the arts are into those people who are prepared to take chances and who are two steps ahead. And AI can't, to my knowledge anyway, do that element of it very well, which means there's only a limited extent to which AI can replace the true tastemakers of the world.
I agree. There's human creativity and emotion that a robot will never be able to replicate or feel or do. You've obviously played at massive festivals and smaller venues like in clubs. So the difference between the two, obviously your energy input into what you're doing is the same, but what is the difference for you? And is there one that you prefer more than the other, you know, massive festival compared to like the smaller venues?
I think in an ideal scenario, over the course of a couple of months, you want to be doing a bit of both. Smaller venues have the sort of whites of their eyes, the ability to take more chances, just feeling a closeness with the crowd, which is really what I get the biggest buzz out of. It's not just playing the music, it's the proximity of the crowd. Whereas at some festivals, the majority, in fact, you're up on a stage, there's a crash barrier at the front. So there's always a sort of a fairly significant gap between you and the crowd, which is, it is what it is, because it's generally a very big crowd. So you've got that kind of feeling of an enormous amount of people in front of you, but you haven't got the closeness and the kind of whites of their eyes connection.
With your music, do you create your own music, or do you only sort of do remixes of other artists, or combination of both?
A bit of both, yeah. I mean, I do. I play other people's records. I play my own remixes of other people's records, my own, especially my own one-off versions that I just keep, I create for my own DJ sets only. And then I make my own records as well, a bit of everything. You want to, it's difficult, especially when you've been around a long time. You've got, my market is predominantly sort of over 35s, although that doesn't mean that I don't have a young audience there as well, but that's where my predominant market lies. So you don't want to upset the people who've known you historically, but at the same time, you don't want to be, I don't know, Tom Jones rattling out the same old hits at the same time. Yeah. So the challenge is to be original and relevant to a new market, meanwhile kind of incorporating elements of things that have, that people might have loved about you in the past.
Okay, so now let's dive into creative world. When you're taking a song by another artist and you're remixing it and you creating your own spin on it, what inspires you to choose certain songs or certain records to remix, and how do you approach that?
Well, the choice is very often based on things that haven't been, you know, raped and pillaged before, really. Because there are certain records that have been remixed so many times. I don't know, Mr. Brightside by the Killers, or Seven Nations Army. I'm stating the most glaringly obvious one, Nations Army, or things like that. So you want to steer clear of the obvious. You want things that have got an element of familiarity that haven't been absolutely remixed to death by everybody else. Ideally, things that haven't been touched at all. And you need to think hard about it. And often you get a kind of eureka moment listening to the radio, or just, and you just, you know, to put it, you put a note in the notes section of your phone and you think, yeah, that one is going to work amazingly well. And it's particularly relevant for the summer festival season, I'd say, and this applies to many other DJs. We probably 2/3 of our work is in 1/3 of the year, which, or a little bit more than 1/3 of the year. You know, May through to September is where the biggest concentration of gigs is, and that's when all the big gigs take place. So you've almost got to sort of prepare for the summer season doing more of those sort of tracks than you otherwise would. And then in terms of what the creative process is, you've just got to have, if you like, a mind's eye. It's funny, some of my family members play GTA, Grand Theft Auto, which has got, you know, one of the world's biggest games. I'm not much of a gamer myself, but they've got this, I don't know if you're familiar, they've got this, all this clubbing stuff in there where they show you a couple of famous DJs have obviously lent their moniker to it. And you see these kind of identikit kind of clubs that the gangsters in the game go into. And you've almost got to have like this mind's eye image of a almost a gamer version of what a festival's like in your head.
Okay.
And then create a record that you think is going to work in this surreal gamer version of a festival. It's almost like you roll all the festival and big gig experiences into one idea and try and create something that's going to work in that environment. And that's the best you can hope for. And most of the time you play it out and it works. Sometimes things need tweaks and you go back in the studio. One of the great luxuries of being a DJ stroke music maker that we all have, those of us that have enough gigs, is the ability to test records in front of people.
Yes.
And some things just work immediately, and hopefully experience will enable you to create things that do work immediately. But the reality is there's a huge difference between the way something sounds in your home studio and the way it sounds on a big set of speakers. It's a different environment. But the luxury is the ability to go away and sort of tweak stuff once you've done it for a first time.
And is it the same approach when you're creating your own original music, or what is your approach with that?
Well, it depends what you're trying to do with original music. I've always had I've always been a relatively genre agnostic. I like lots of different areas of music. Most there are many other DJs who are a little narrower in their in what they like doing, whereas I like quite a broad spectrum of music. So first and foremost, it depends what you're trying to do. You know, whether you're trying to do something more listening orientated, I might make certain records that I'm focusing more on a listening angle, you know, slightly more chilled angle, and other things that I'm doing directly for the dance floor. It depends. I guess it's, you know, part of that is dependent on what else is in your record box in that given month, whether you're almost trying to fill certain gaps in a record box that aren't catered for by what is out there.
You mentioned earlier on about that energy and that feeling sort of being the addiction. Beyond that element, what keeps you going, performing, being on stage, DJing? What other elements do you enjoy about it?
It's all I've ever known. It sounds crazy to say it, but you know, the thought of having to sit at home watching Strictly Come Dancing on a Saturday night, which I've never done, is motivation enough. Since I've been an adult, I've probably not had more than 4 to 6 Saturday nights at home per year in all of that period. You know, we're talking in decades. So I'm institutionalized to be going out and traveling and meeting new people. And it's not just about the set, you know, it's meeting the promoter, being courteous to the person who's paid you to be there, having a conversation, finding out about their life, finding out about the club, finding out about the venue, finding out about the history of the promoter, who the crowd are, how often, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's not just because I'm not just doing it to be polite. I'm genuinely interested because I'm a, you know, ambassador, probably blowing my own trumpet a bit too far, but I'm somebody who believes in our scene enormously and cares about the way that the late night, well, not even late night, the sort of clubbing stroke festival market, particularly in the UK, is prospering. So, you know, it's part of a bigger picture, really. I tend to turn up quite early before my sets when I DJ, generally leave immediately afterwards because you want to leave on a high. You don't want to sort of be sat there waiting for an hour as the kind of vibe and the adrenaline just dissipates into nothing. So, but I always get to my every gig pretty early, an hour at least, if not plenty more.
I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 2 hours, 2 days, I know your answer will be different every single time. I recognize that and appreciate that. But if you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists, once we finish this conversation, what would be those 5 songs and by whom?
I guess we're talking classics, because if you were asking me about current records, I'd need to dig through my current DJ folder. Art of Noise, Moments in Love, because it's the original chill out record. The Clash, London Calling, because I'm a born and raised Londoner, and I think it's the best record about my home city. And my favourite football team come out of the tunnel every match to get to the track as well. Joe Smooth, Promised Land, because I think it's one of the greatest songs that's ever been immortalised on a house record. Eric B and Rakim, Paid in Full, the Cold Cut remix, because it was the original sample record. That's just how they cleared, or, you know, putting my lawyer head on alone, how they cleared all those samples on the record. And let's think of another one. I suppose Energy 52, Café Del Mar, because it was the original sort of trance record that kind of opened the door to a genre that was hugely successful.
I love that list. Jules, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message to the audience, what would you like to say?
Please explore me. sounds quite cheesy. Please explore me, not in the physical sense, in the digital sense.